Good evening, everyone. It's Tuesday, February 15th, 2011. We're back to Who's Who in the Talmud in our Tuesday night class. It seems like ages, since we've had one of these. I think we last left off with the death of Rabbi Akiva. Yeah, we're doing actually a mailing afterwards.
Yeah,
so
yeah,
awesome. So we're actually getting back to this now, and I picked to do Rav Meir this week because, well, why not? I think we're going to split up Rav Meir too. One thing that we found with Reb, I guess with the first few people that we discussed in the Who's Who and the Talmud, there wasn't a lot mentioned about them in the Talmud itself. Or by Talmud I mean Mishnaic sources. We just don't have a lot. So it was a lot easier to just do something comprehensive. Say, you know, if we only have 20 sources on this guy, we can actually do all 20 sources and then start thinking, well, what does this mean? As we saw with Rabbi Akiva, I think we split that up into four different weeks, and even then only barely scratched the surface. We may be splitting, I think we may split up a few Tanam and Amarim into multiple weeks, because otherwise you're just not going to have a real sense of what they're about. Not to say that you can in a week anyway. I think I said you could probably turn most of these Tanam and Amarim into their own like class, if you actually spend time going through every single time that they're referenced in the Gemara. And then, as we discussed methodologically several times, the issues of are these attributions accurate? On one hand, you have, say, the opinions of Professor Jacob Neusner, who believes that none of the attributions can be taken seriously. But even if you do take the attribution seriously, you have different extant versions, some within the Gemara itself, where in one Masechet you'll have a narrative or halacha said in one person's name. In another Gemara, it'll be in a different person's name. Or sometimes even within the same block of Gemara, you can find a term like Ika de Amri, meaning it'll say this person says it, or some say this person said it. So even within, you know, the span of two lines, or even one line, depending on how long the line is, you know, immediately you find that there's some dispute as to whom are we attributing this statement. That's even before we get to, you know, critical editions in different manuscripts, where one version of the Babylonian Talmud, that exact same passage, can have it in one way, whereas another one won't. Like, we have the Vilna Shas, but if you check out, say, one of the manuscripts found in the Vatican, you might have the exact same Gemara, except written with someone else, you know, speaking. You know, so putting that aside for, you know, we're trying to get sort of an overview here. This is not an in-depth academic study. It's a lot more survey work, you know, for that very reason. So we'll keep that in context. A few quick facts about Rav Meir. He was a fourth generation Tana, 139 to 163. That would be CE, because you notice that it's the numbers increase as opposed to the ones that were BCE, it, you know, decreases. What comes to mind immediately when you see dates, which, you know, we haven't really seen since from Rabbi Akiva? Well, since he was born in 139, then he was born after the destruction of the temple.
70.
Right? Yeah. 70 was the destruction of the Second Temple. So a lot of the sources that we've seen up until now, a lot of the Tanaim that we've seen up until now lived at some point during, you know, the Second Temple period, if not actually lived through part of it and witnessed its destruction. So Rabbi Meir is already at a position now where he's, you know, the world in which he's living is after the temple was already destroyed, and the nature of what it meant to be Jewish changed drastically. So he's mentioned over 3,500 times in rabbinic literature. You know, it's, I forget the exact number that came up from a Bar Ilan search, but it's, you know, mentioned, you know, not infrequently there. He was a student of Rabbi Akiva, and he was close with his teacher, Elisha ben Avuya, also known as Acher, whom I've been thinking we may need to spend a week on it, or we may tie it in with Rav Meir, hard to tell, because they did have an interesting relationship there.
We could possibly associate it with Monday class, too.
Not a bad, you know, the politics of exclusion thing. Yeah, not a bad idea. I'm not sure why it didn't include Acher, but that's, you know, I think we'll keep that for the Tuesday, because it's more about the person. We've already, you know, left the Gemara side behind. So let's get started here. The first section pulled in a few sources about Rabbi Meir's personal life. Dana, first one, this is Gittin 56a.
Yeah, I'm
fair enough.
He, the emperor, sent against them Nero the Caesar. As he was coming, he shot an arrow toward the east, and it fell in Jerusalem. He then shot one toward the west, and it again fell in Jerusalem. He shot toward all four points of the compass, and each time it fell in Jerusalem. He said to a certain boy, "Repeat to me the last verse of scripture you've learned." He said, "And I will lay my vengeance upon Edom by the hand of my people Israel." He said, "The Holy One, blessed be he, desires to lay waste his house and to lay the blame on me." So he ran away and became a proselyte, and Rav was descended from him.
Mm-hmm. The context in this Gemara is the section here discusses a lot of narratives relating to the destruction of the temple. It's on for several pages about that. According to this Gemara, and I guess it's been a while since we even discussed methodology, if we're taking this as pure historical fact, then we're saying, oh, Rabbi Meir was a descendant of
Caesar.
Yeah, of the emperor, right, Nero. Yeah, again, Nero the Caesar. At least, that's his lineage. Which you can on one hand say, this is historical fact, or alternative. I mean, there are, I'm trying to stress, there are different ways of reading this. There certainly is a tradition about this. Notable, it's kind of in unattributed Aramaic, which means it's a later source. The Talmudic admissions might call this the Stam, which would be the final redactor who put this together, who is writing this possibly a little anachronistically, retrojecting a bit, because he's writing several generations after this would have happened. Again, theory, we're not quite sure exactly where this came from, but it would reflect a tradition about Rebbe Meir. Meaning, even if we don't assume that this is historical fact, that Rebbe Meir was the product of this lineage, there still is, I think, something fascinating here that, A, they would tell this story, and B, that Rav Meir, of all people, would have been associated with this individual. Yeah.
This seems a little out there. Is there a chance this is, figurative?
Yes. There's probably a very good chance it's figurative. But even if it isn't, even if you take it figuratively, right, there's a different type of truth involved. Meaning, if it might not be historical truth, it could be telling you a truth about Rav Meir's personality, his character, or his legacy. Because if, let's say, you just come up with a story, and let's say this is just a tall tale someone made up, why Rav Meir? If you're going to attribute, any Tana, you have a bunch of his contemporaries, you can say, oh, he was the product of this, right? Or just say, oh, the guy ran away and became a ger, why does Rav Meir have to come from him at all? Meaning, you could have also stopped the story right there. So there was some reason, even if you're assuming that this is, fabricated, there is a reason why this tradition existed. I'm actually even assuming it's a tradition, that went on for generations, but there is a reason why Rav Meir was associated there. Now, we haven't seen enough of Rav Meir, but it's an interesting thing to think about, where either you treat it as historical fact, and this is, Rav Meir's lineage, or alternatively, why is Rav Meir being used here? And what does that say either about Rav Meir, or how is Rav Meir viewed by later generations?
Actually, I was only referring to the first half.
Oh. Yeah. About the whole shooting arrow deal.
Yeah.
It's an interesting question like that, and one of the reasons why to say that you can't trust a Gaddic material as historical fact is the very simple question of, well, how do you know this? We discussed a few times people are reporting dialogues that happened between two people in prison. Right. Well, how would you know that unless you were actually there? So unless there was a messenger who saw Caesar do this, or unless there was some story, I don't know. Again, I wasn't there. Possible, yes, but it doesn't necessarily disqualify the point of it being included.
The last half seems a little more plausible.
It does seem a little more, in terms of the first part being plausible, I think they're equally plausible. Especially the point here about asking a child, what did you learn today? You find that used several times in the Gemara as an oracle in some sort of way. So it would not be out of the ordinary.
I was really referring more to the arrow, but okay.
Yeah. minimally it's inoffensive. Otherwise, there's probably something else here, but it's something to keep in the back of your head of either he was a descendant, or there was some reason why people wanted to make this association with him. Jane, welcome back. Take source number 2. This is Brachot 10a.
There were once some highwaymen in the neighborhood of Rabbi Meir who caused him a great deal of trouble. Rabbi Meir accordingly prayed that they should die. His wife, Beruria, said to him, "How do you make out that such a prayer should be permitted? Because it is written, 'Let Hatayim cease.' Is it written..."
Meaning, so there's a verse that says, I mean, the Sensino here didn't translate it. It's Yitamu Hatayim. It's the end of 104 in Tehillim, say it in Barchi Nafshi, the Psalm of the Day that we say for Rosh Chodesh, so all the way at the end there. So it says, you know, destroy Chataim, this word, Chataim. Right?
Is it written Chatim?
Chotim.
Chotim.
It is written Chataim, meaning the... When it says destroy with this word, is chataim. Anyone identify what the root is of chataim?
Hate.
Hate, sin. So the question is, does it say destroy the sinner or destroy the sin?
Destroy the sin.
That's, although I do believe that, the funny thing is that biblical Hebrew grammar buff says, no, this actually does mean, you know, destroy the sinner too, but...
But no, but she makes a good point.
She makes an exegetical point which the, I guess, medakdikim, no pun intended there, of biblical Hebrew, will actually say that she got the grammar incorrect. Point is, of me including this whole thing, well, actually, finish the story.
"Further, look at the end of the verse, 'And let the wicked men be no more. Since the sins will cease, there will be no more wicked men. Rather, pray for them that they should repent, and there will be no more wicked.' He did pray for them, and they repented."
All right, so simple story here. Main reason why I included this here in his personal life is that this is where we're told explicitly, A, he had a wife. B, his wife was Beria, whom is...
Yeah. The daughter of Rabbi...
What was she more known for?
She was a Talmud scholar as well.
Dana? Any other thoughts?
I don't remember anything more particular than she was really knowledgeable.
Right. So
she's also the only one ever mentioned really in the Talmud.
She's not the only one. There are a couple of women mentioned, but since it's so infrequent where women are mentioned, where women mentioned by name, meaning you can say, oh, so-and-so's wife said this, so-and-so's wife said that. She's mentioned by name. When Rabbi Dr. Judith Hauptman came and spoke last time here, she spoke specifically on Beria, and in particular, like, certain narratives about her, where in a Jerusalem Talmud, a certain passage doesn't have her mentioned, and in the Babylonian version, it does have her mentioned, which is fascinating in its own right. And you know, it's important because... we'll actually see this next week a little. The figure of Beria has sort of been an archetype for Jewish feminists as being someone who is mentioned who could not only learn knowledgeable but argue and argue successfully with men. There's actually one place in the Tosefta I can think of off the top of my head where she makes a halachic contribution, where there is a discussion. She says, "Here's what I think it is," and someone says, "Yeah, she's right." You know, and she's kind of treated as a peer. But this is Rav Meir's wife. Another one that Gemara Nida 24b that I just thought was cute was, "And should you suggest that Abba Shaul was a dwarf, it may be mentioned that Abba Shaul was the tallest man in his generation, and Rabbi Tarfon reached to his shoulder. And Rabbi Tarfon was the tallest man in his generation, and Rav Meir reached to his shoulder." So the only reason why I'm including this here is that there's some indicator that Rav Meir was tall. Or at least,
or that
but
he was
not
the tallest of his generation.
Well, tallest of, yeah, but
doesn't mean that he was tall.
Well, so why do we start with dwarf?
The context is more of, look, you could probably guess that from the context of this Gemara Nida in 24 is that it's about something about Rav Avishal. And by dwarf, it wasn't, you know, my choice of words here, it was in Sinos, but you can understand, well, maybe Rav Avishal was special because he was short. Oh, but we know that he was tall.
Aruch means tall, doesn't it?
Yes, but...
Is it a euphemism?
No, it's actually talking about physical stature.
Yeah.
In context. Yeah. That's why I said I put it in, because it's, you know, a cute gemara about things that you don't normally expect people to say.
Oh, tallest thing. Sorry.
Yeah. Yeah. Meaning it's not like who's the greatest in terms of, like, biggest scholar. It's
the tallest.
He was physically tall. Yeah. It's one of the things that, you know, why you find doing Who's Who in the Talmud can be interesting, because you're looking at the same gemara, you know, except instead of looking at it halakhically, you're trying to piece out little bits of, I don't want to say trivia, because I don't think they are trivial, but you're picking out other pieces of information about these people in these members of Chazal. You know, how would you know? It's a throwaway line, but you start piecing all these things together, you have a better idea of who this individual was. An interesting narrative here, Gemara in Sanhedrin 13b to 14a, about the ordination of Rav Meir. Take it, Dana.
Can I try the Aramaic?
Do the English. It's a little bit long.
Okay.
Thanks.
Cannot one man alone ordain? Did not Rav Yehuda say, say in Rav's name, may this man indeed be remembered for his blessing. His name is Rav Yehuda ben Baba. Were it not for him, the laws of Kenas?
Yeah, I don't know why it didn't translate that, but Kenas means fines. The laws of fines would have been forgotten from Israel.
Kenasos? Dine Kenasos Israel?
Didn't do the translation.
No, I'm saying that's the text that corresponds
to, the text that corresponds to is
laws of Kenas would be forgotten in Israel. Forgotten? Then they could have been learned. But these laws might have been abolished because once the wicked government, as an act of religious persecution, decreed that whoever informed an ordination should be put to death, and whoever received ordination should be put to death, the city in which the ordination took place demolished, and the boundaries wherein it had been performed uprooted.
Right. So right here, we're talking about, laying the context here of what were, the difficulties of perpetuating the Jewish tradition, which was, if you ordain any new rabbi, not only, are you going to be put to death, but the entire place is going to be wiped out. So go ahead.
What did Rabbi Yehuda ben Baba do? He went and sat between two great mountains that lay between two large cities, between the Sabbath boundaries of the city the cities of Usha and Shepharim, and there ordained five elders, viz. Reb Meir, Reb Yehuda, Reb Shimon, Reb Yossi, and Reb Elezer ben Shemua.
Mm-hmm.
Rav, one second.
Avia is fine. It's really Avia.
I was trying to catch up in the Aramaic, but never mind. Rav
Avia.
Avia adds also Rav Nechemia in the list. As soon as their enemies discovered them,
Judah ben Baba.
Oh, okay, right, good. Urge them, my children, flee. They said to him, what will become of thee, Rabbi? I lie before them like a stone which none is concerned to overturn. He was said that the enemy did not stir from the spot until they had driven 300 iron spearheads into his body, making it like a sieve. Sit. With Rav Yehuda ben Baba were in fact some others. But in honor to him, they were not mentioned.
Yeah. This might bring you flashbacks to the movie The 300. Well, not The 300, 300. No one saw that?
Is it?
No.
Is
okay,
it
never mind that reference.
There's a C and a sieve. Never mind. A Kriyanic sieve.
Ah.
Sorry.
Nicely done there. Where he got ordained was with five, possibly six. And this also, again, shows you, even when the Gemara is trying to give you history, there's a debate whether or not Rav Nechemia was included among them. It's a matter of history. There's a small bit of doubt there. But he was ordained in a time of great persecution. And after he was ordained, Rav Yehuda ben Baba protected, if not single-handedly, but pretty well, gave his life so that everyone else could escape.
Why did the question come up?
I mean, what's the context?
Well, I mean, the first question is, can one man ordain a rabbi? So,
as opposed to a beis din. the context in the Gemara here is about what is the process of ordination, like real ordination back in the day with the Sanhedrin in Israel, not like the smicha we have today.
Okay.
Yeah. So take the next paragraph.
Was Rav Meir indeed ordained by Rav Yehuda ben Baba? Did not Rabba Bar Chana says in Rav Yochanan's name, he who asserts that Rav Meir was not ordained by Rav Akiva is certainly in error. Okay, that's question.
Meaning, right. Why are you saying that he was ordained by Rav Yehuda ben Baba when someone else said in the name of Rav Yochanan,
it would be
in error. Meaning, his smicha came from Rav Akiva.
Right. Rav Akiva had indeed ordained him, but the ordination was not acceptable. Rashi says due to his age. While due to Rabbi Akiva's age.
No, it's due to Rabbi Meir's age. Meaning he got ordination, according to Rashi, right? Well,
he was the youngest.
Let's put it aside, in terms of why for a second. But, the Gemara says, the way that you can reconcile these two sources is his first ordination from Rabbi Akiva wasn't accepted for one reason or another. And the second one was. Which, you should also note, is not unlike today, where if you get or smicha from one institution, others will say, we don't accept it. Go get it from another one.
Okay.
Trust me, this happens.
Yeah, but there are some where that's never going to happen, right? MTJ.
I will leave the questions of modern day rabbinic politics. I'll table that for a moment.
All right.
But at any rate, again, this source, the reason why I'm including it here is it gives us some indication not only of. The world in which Rabbi Meir was learning, right, under really severe persecution, but also about he got according to the conclusion of this Gemara, which seems to be from the anonymous Aramaic sources that try to gloss over. Well, we've got two different traditions, and the answer is he got two smichas. Meaning one person said he got, which is not uncommon to happen in the Gemara. Meaning if you just take the attributed statements at face value, you've got one opinion, one source that says, oh, he got smicha from Yehuda ben Baba. Another source that says he got it from Rabbi Akiva. So instead of saying one's right and one's wrong, you're saying, well, they're both right. It's just, here's how things went down. Right? Also, take another thing into consideration here, based on the first source that we saw of him in terms of, being the descendant of a convert. Right?
It's all into question.
Well, I wouldn't say it necessarily calls it into question, but given that he would have been the product of the government that helped destroy the temple, and he's still living in this time of persecution, I'm going to throw out a possibility here, a suggestion that one reason why it might have been attributed to Rav Meir is to provide some degree of balance. Meaning you've got, wicked government tries to uproot all of Judaism, continues to do so. He is actually the product of not just a random person,
but one of the heads there.
And yet he's going to be one of the people who is perpetuating Judaism in the face of such persecution. Again, completely speculative. Jane, take number 5 on the list here. It's Gittin 4a.
Rabbi Ashi said, shall I tell you who the authority of the Mishnah is? It is Rav Yehuda, as shown by the following Mishnah. Rabbi Yehuda declares the get invalid unless it has been both written and signed on something not attached to the soil.
Yeah.
Why did we not at the outset declare Rabbi Yehuda to be the authority? We tried, if possible, to base ourselves on the authority of Rabbi Meir, because where a Mishnah is stated anonymously, its author is Rabbi Meir.
Right. This is a principle that you may hear in yeshiva from time to time. The Stam Mishnah is Rav Meir. What that means is, if you find an opinion in the Mishnaic source that is unattributed, meaning it's not that Rabbi says this or Rabbi said that. Also, when you read by attribution, it's usually not so-and-so says F, so-and-so says Y. It's usually statement, divrei, whomever. Meaning you have a statement of something in the Mishnah, comma, said person. And then in contrast, other people or chachamim say something else. Right, so by unattributed, I mean something that is not mentioned at all. Not attributed at all to one person, either before or after the statement made. The default, according to this Gemara, is it's Rav Meir. Which is an important point, because that means, you know, in theory, that even though he wouldn't necessarily pop up, a lot of his teachings were recorded in the Mishnah, just that he wouldn't have been, you know, it wouldn't, exactly, wouldn't have been acknowledged, or not explicitly. Right?
It's a lot of English for 2.5 lines of Hebrew Aramaic.
Yeah, because it explains, you know, it's going into a little bit more about the Mishnah. Gemara in Eruvin 13b, Rav Acha ben Chanina said, it's revealed and known before him, or he who spoke in the world came into existence, that in the generation of Rav Meir there was none equal to him. And why was not the halacha fixed in agreement with his views? Because his colleagues could not fathom the depths of his mind, for he would declare the ritually unclean to be clean and supply plausible proof, and the ritually clean to be unclean and also supply plausible proof. We'll talk a little bit more next week about, you know, some of his opinions. But according to Rabbi Acha ben Chanina, this Gemara in Eruvin 13b, Rav Meir was considered that in his generation he was the best. But you would think, why not follow the best? And his answer is interesting. It's, he was too good. He was so good that no one could understand him. Does anyone know offhand of where we saw something similar to this? As someone being too good or too smart for their own good, so to speak? Yeah.
No. Just waving at me.
All right. Well, something to think about. So now, Gemara and Sanhedrin about... I'll tell you what. Email me after class for the exact citation. But it's not the first time that we find it. So I'll tell you right off the bat, to Gemara and Sanhedrin, and it discusses the first instance of where we find Yore Smicha, Yadin Smicha, the whole question, Yore, Yadin. Anyway, nice little thing there. Dana, take Gemara and Sota 49a.
When Rav Meir died, the composers of fables ceased.
Right. Mishamet Rabbi Meir Butlu Moshele Mishalim. What do you think that means? Moshele Mishalim. Fables is, I think, a really, really bad translation here of Mashal. Maybe not. A Mashal is more of it could mean an analogy, which I guess you could say a fable really is an analogy. But he's considered really like the greatest in this in terms of his presentation. It's like, you know, I'll give you a mashal, like I'll give you an analogy for it. And it's actually, the citation is a Gemara and so it's a 49a, but it's actually in the Mishnah, and it's really considered that this is one of the things he was really known for. So if you combine the Gemara in Erevin with his Mishnah in Sota, he didn't just have a brilliant mind in Halacha, but he also had a brilliant mind in Mishalim, which I find is an interesting contrast, because the whole point of a Mashal, to give an analogy, is to make something easier to be understood. And yet, despite that, you know, people, you know, didn't really know what he was saying. It's an interesting counterbalance.
Well, you know, if somebody is... If they said, I mean, you pointed out in the excerpt before that they couldn't necessarily follow him anyway, so he had to try and simplify it on some level.
Good way of putting it too. And it might even say that the fact that he was able to take his deep thoughts and put it into an analogy meant that he must have gotten really good at it, you know, if he was forced to do so. It's an excellent point. Didn't think of that. Jane, take number 8. Should be
Rabba Bar Hana.
Yeah.
Said in the name of Rabbi
Yohanan,
it is forbidden to write one letter save from a copy.
Meaning, when you're writing, say, a scroll, you can't do it from memory. You need to have a text in front of you and copy over. Yeah.
The following was cited in opposition to this. It happens once that Rabbi Meir went to prolong the year in a seer.
Yeah.
And there was no Megillah there, and he wrote one out by heart.
Yeah. And then it describes, you know, just how great his mind was, that he knew. Now, we're not just saying
memory.
Yeah, but think about what does it mean to know from memory. It's not just knowing Tanakh. It's knowing all the kris and the ksivs, going back to Dana's earlier joke, meaning whether or not it's written, say, with a yud or written without a yud, whether or not a letter is written with a vav or without a vav. Not only was he a scribe, but he has, I guess you would call this an eidetic memory, which is a little bit...
Beyond photographic.
In a sense, yeah. Well, I guess you could say it's photographic, but I would call this more eidetic, because you really have it all down. in order to be able to do this. And then the Gemara explains why he was so exceptional. You know, why he was allowed to do it even though typically you're not supposed to.
He was living in a time of persecution.
Mm-hmm.
What are the chances they let him slide if he just for night?
It's an interesting question. They tend not to rely on that unless they absolutely positively have to. As far as I can tell. I mean, you're right. Also, you don't know when certain things happen. I mean, if the persecution sort of let up a little, right, then it wouldn't have applied. We don't necessarily know what point in their lives certain things happen. They're not dated, right? But even so, like, you know, it is used every now and again that in Ahura Atsha'ah, or Shatatchak, and I believe that is used in this context later on in the Gemara, you can have certain dispensations, and it's basically, this is why he could do it, but you can't. Right. You had a question, Jane?
Is it Rabbi Meir that was compared to a cistern that held water and never leaked? Does that sound familiar to you?
That wasn't Rav Meir. My God, that was... the person to whom you were referring was Rabbi Eliezer ben Horkinus. Yes, it is all in Pirkei Avot, chapter 2. Really, the discussion is from 9 towards the end about the students of Rav Yochanan ben Zakkai. All right? Not Rav Meir, but it's worthwhile going through that. So... then we have a really fascinating Gemara in Horayot. And this gets into a little bit of the politics, which is why I put in the professional section here. So whenever Reb Shimon ben Gamliel, entered, all the people stood up for him. I should mention this is Horayot 13b. So when Reb Shimon ben Gamliel entered, all the people stood up for him. When Reb Meir and Reb Natan entered, all the people stood up for them also. Said Reb Shimon ben Gamliel, should there be no distinction between my office and theirs? He was, really the head. Again, going through the translations, but it's not a bad translation of what's going on here.
No.
Anyway, and so he issued that ordinance. The Gemara said further up that when the Nasi enters, all the people rise and do not resume their seats until he requests to sit. But when the Av Beidin, sort of the head of the court, enters, one row rises on one side, another row on the other, and they remain standing until he has sat down in his place. Meaning, there was a different sense of kavod of, you know, if everyone just rises and, you know, sits, but like, shouldn't you distinguish between the two different, you know, different levels and layers? So according to this, the Nav Basin is kind of like the, you know, closer to the I know it's not closer to the judge, but everyone rises before it comes in. Well, whatever. Point is this. You know, he made a distinction such that the Nasi would have a greater degree of kavod, of honor, than the Av Beitin. So Rav Meir and Rav Natan were not present on that day. Coming on the following day, and seeing that the people did not rise for them as usual, they inquired as to what happened. On being told that Rav Shimon ben Gamliel had issued the ordinance, Rav Meir said to Rav Natan, I am the Chinkam and you are the Av Beitin, let us retaliate. How are we to proceed against him? Let us request him to discourse on the tractate of Uktzin, with which he is unfamiliar, and he will be unable to discourse. Upon it we shall tell them, who can express the mighty acts of the Lord and make all his praise be should probably be heard. Copied and pasted, this typo I blame on them. For whom it is becoming to express the mighty acts of the Lord, for him who can make all his praise heard, we shall then depose him, and I shall become the Avitin, and you the Nasi. Rav Yaakov ben Korshai, in hearing this conversation, said, the matter might, God forbid, lead to the Nasi's disgrace. Can't imagine why he would get to that assumption. So he went and sat down behind Rav Shimon ben Gamliel's study, expounding the tractate of Uktzin, repeating it again and again. He said, what could this mean? Did anything, God forbid, happen at the college? He concentrated his attention, familiarized himself with it. On the following day, they said to him, will the master come and discourse on Uktzin? He began and discoursed on it. After he had finished, he had said to them, had I not familiarized with it, you would have disgraced me. He gave the order, and they were removed from the college. Thereupon, they wrote down scholastic difficulties on slips of paper, which they threw into the college. That which he solved was disposed of, and that to which he did not solve, they wrote down the answers and threw them in. said Rav Yossi to them, the Torah is without and we are within. Said Rav Shmuel Gamliel to them, we shall readmit them, but impose upon them this penalty that no traditional statement shall be reported in their names. As a result, Rabbi Meir was designated, quote, others, and Rabbi Nathan was designated, as some say. In their dreams, they received a message to go and pacify Rav Shmuel ben Gamliel. Rav Nathan went, Rav Meir did not, for he said, dreams are of no consequence. When Rav Nathan came, Rav Shmuel ben Gamliel remarked to him, the honorable position of your father has indeed helped you become the Av Beit Din. Shall we therefore make you also a Nasi? Rabbi taught his son Rav Shimon, others say that if it had been exchanged bees, it would not have been sacrificed. Slight digression here, go back to the last few lines of the source there. Even Rabbi, who is unassuming, used the expression, it is said in the name of Rav Meir. He did not say Rabbi Meir said. So even though this might appear a little bit earlier in terms of why is Rabbi Meir said is, you know, might be anonymous. So according to this Gemara in Horayot, it's attributed to this really odd narrative, which, you know, we can leave up to people here to consider. We may remember that Rav Shmuel ben Gamliel wasn't necessarily the easiest person with which to deal. We saw a thing with Rav Yehoshua. But here we have sort of a different spin on the matter where, you know, anyway, it's an interesting Gemara. I will leave it up as food for thought for people to consider. We'll continue with a little bit more of Rav Meir. He has some really fascinating ideas, and he's actually consistent with a few points that appear in many areas of Jewish law. All right. So next week we'll continue with Rav Meir. Oh, sorry. Questions.
So basically, he made a layman. He prepared, and then he was able to give shear.
Yeah, but he said Rav Shmuel ben Gamliel was able to recognize if I didn't do this, you would have embarrassed me. Meaning he was sort of able to realize that there was a coup. Because look, Uktzin is something that virtually no one studies, no one knows, and the only reason why you would bring it up is if, you know, you're trying to be annoying, because it wouldn't be something that would have been relevant or practical. It would be, it's like, oh, let's see if he knows this.
Yeah.
And, you know, the whole point was, and they knew he didn't know it. That was the whole reason why they did it to begin with.
So what is it that we learn in Uxin?
Separate issue. I'll sit there. All right. So we'll continue with Rav Meir next week. Have a great week.